It really is good to be here. I don't know how many of you have been around for some of it, but I think the last 2 months, just Jared leading and walking us through has been so good. Just his addition to Cornerstone. The one thing I don't think you'll ever leave Cornerstone and wonder, did we worship God? Just he always makes sure, and I so appreciate that, just what God's done through him. And even to the last 2 months, man, I hope you've appreciated just the different guys that have come up and preached. One person said, gosh, you're not preaching, I feel like you love us. And let me tell you something. Let me put it this way. The reason I have them preach is because I love you. I listen to what they preached on. I hear Josh, and I don't know how many of you noticed that, but you know how Josh articulates things that you wish you could say like that? Matt, just this guy that puts his heart out there on his sleeve that so you just connect with and you understand where he's coming from. And even too, man, Terry, he starts to talk and just with his voice you get a little hug. And even last week, just hearing Preston preach, I just thought he did a great job. And so like my whole heart, like I said, is to always put up here the person that I really think is going to do the best job because I do love this church so much. And the other part about it is that this summer, we're going to add another person into this, which is Christian Burkhart. And I don't know if you know him as our children's guy. Somebody gave him. That's good. Yay. Yay. Thank you. Christian's not here, but I know he would appreciate it. But he understands Exodus. Like when he talks to me about Exodus, I'm like, I need to go read that book. I mean, he just understands it the way he talks about it. He gets excited about it. So anyways, he's going to be walking with us. But last week, we started preaching on this whole idea of the Pentateuch. And I know some people are like, oh, Pentateuch. But I hope what you saw from last week from Preston opening us up, man, it's going to be a great summer. I mean, I just think looking at some of the stuff that he preached on, I think some people say, oh, I just wish God was more relatable. And in the way he presented it, man, God was more relatable. But the other thing that I hope you don't miss about the Pentateuch, aren't you glad we have a God that's outside of our comprehension? Aren't you glad you can't relate to him on certain levels? I mean, if you could relate to him, then therefore he's not a very big God. And the Pentateuch just takes who God is and just explodes him into this bigger view. And so that's what we're hoping to do this summer. But this week as I was preparing, to be real honest, I wish I would have preached last week. Part of it is like last week, man, Preston's preaching. It's like everything is good, 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 very good. And then I sit down and I'm starting to study my passage and it's like bad, worse, worstest, even though it's not a word. I'm just like, jeez. Last week, you know, Preston spoke of just God flinging stars off into the universe, and then here's God the Father sitting there all giddy watching. What is Adam going to do? This week, I get God, and he's lamenting and grieving. Yay. Yay. Last week, it's so funny to sit there and watch Preston make those cute little funny little animal noises. This week, the noises that come out of the passage are like weeping and screaming. Last week, Preston got to talk about this idea of him being relatable and transcendent. In other words, you have to look up on Google to understand it. It's just, here's my words. I wrote them down. Death, murder, mayhem, rebellion, drowning, and judgment. So let me just kind of give this as a forewarning as we look into this passage. Today we ain't going to be exactly riding the happy train to Pleasantville. The passage, the way it talks about it, it's not happy-go-lucky. But let me caveat something here, okay? Because I think this week the thing I've loved is what God has taught me. Is all those things being said, all that stuff, this path that we're going to walk on today, I have learned to love a side of God sometimes we don't like to look at. We love to see the happy pants side of God, don't we? I mean, it's like, hey, you know, this whole thing that he presented last week, everyone's like, ah, oh, I want to know that God. But let me tell you something. Sometimes the side of God that we don't like to look at is the side we need to see the most. Let me say that again. Sometimes the side of God we don't want to look at is the very side we need to see the most. And the way that he's going to walk through this, I think that the way Genesis 3 through 11 talks about it is, on one level, God is scary, he's holy, and he exhibits it in justice and in wrath. But the thing I was thinking about is, aren't you glad that we have a God that's holy and he will demand justice? I mean, aren't you? Aren't you glad that we have this God, that even this other side that we see to him, for the first time ever, we're going to see a God whose heart grieves? I mean, I want to know the God that I serve isn't just this robotic thing that spun things off into existence, but not only is he just and will he mete out his wrath, but he's also this one that the Bible says he has sadness. Where Preston left off last week, what we find is that here's God, and he's created, and he's giddy, and he's watching man name all the animals, and the next thing he does, he pulls a rib out of Adam, and he creates this female, this one that was to be his helper, and he brings her in front of him, and he goes, "What do you want to call her?" And he says, "Woman. That's what I'll call her." And you know, God was like, "Good name." But the thing that's kind of stark when you look at this idea of them being in the garden, it's the thing that has always been something that has chased me down, is not only is there Adam and all the animals, and then you get added to this one that is just his perfect match, this woman, but then there's two trees. Now, the first tree we totally dig, the tree of life. You eat that thing and you just kind of live forever. Life is good. But then this other tree, this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and connected to it is this thing called death. Now, don't get me wrong. If that thing grew in my yard, I would probably pluck it. But God wanted it right there. See, the first thing that I love about God that I just want to cast out to you, that a side of him that we need to understand, is that God does everything with purpose. Nothing happens in all of creation, and that includes in the little garden that he planted, that he put Adam and Eve into. He does everything with purpose. Those trees were there because he meant those trees to be there. Not only that, but I think the big question that used to plague me in the fall of man is why? Why? I mean, it's almost shocking, but the serpent or Satan, he just kind of appears in chapter 3, and it's almost like, oh, what happened? Where did he come from? This evil one that he's called, he slithers in. And as he slithers in, the thing we know about him, he was an angel. He was created by God. In Jude 1:6, it talks about this in verse 6, this idea that he was one created by God, but somewhere in there, he shook his fist at God and he said, "God, I no longer like the plan you have for me. I want to choose to not be subordinate to you anymore. I'm going to live for my own ways, my own things." And somewhere in there, then, he went and did it. Hebrews 1:14 talks about it being he totally didn't want to live out what God had called him to be, where he was to serve others. And specifically, he was to serve God's chief creation. He was to serve God himself. The thing that hits me off of it is he wanted authority. And the question that plagues me is why? And when he slithers into the garden, the first thing he comes up to the woman and says, the way that he gets after her is, "Did God really say that?" See, at the core of every question we ask in life, generally we're asking, "Did God really say that? Do I really have to trust him?" He also weaves into it this understanding that not only did God really say that, but then he says, "Come on, Eve, you know if you eat of that tree, you won't die. You know that when you eat of that tree, in fact, the thing God is afraid of is you will be like him." He just takes Eve and he just lays out this whole idea that you will be like him. Now, like a lot of people, I think they get down to this and they look at it and they go, why would God ever let him in? It turns into chaos. It's offensive. It gets ugly. Why in the world would they? And I think the answer we tend to gravitate for that's not found in the Bible, but we like it, is that somehow God in his grace chose to hold himself back. He chose to make himself less in such a way that man and angels could have this thing called free will. But I struggle with that. I struggle with this idea that somehow God has restricted himself and somehow he's gonna lock himself down and I'm not going to do anything in it, because why in the world would perfect angels that were sitting in the presence of God, if there was this thing free will, the Bible talks about it, no one in any kind of way would ever question God. So that just kind of doesn't work for me. Not only that, but this idea that God being in this sort of helpless position to prevent this mutiny that was taking place around him by these angels is difficult for me to understand, especially in light of everything that Preston spoke about last week. It just makes God look wimpy. But here's the thing I've come to realize, and I love this. Is that I feel what we try to do is we try to answer the wrong question. There's this weird side of us, in trying to ask the wrong question, there's this weird side of us that we actually can look at God and say, why did you do this? In fact, in Romans 9, Paul totally addresses that, where this group of people, he's making out this mock audience where this person is like, God, why did you make me like this? And his answer to that in Romans 9 is, who are you but a human to judge me? Now, we don't like that answer, but that's the answer God gives over and over and over. Who are you? The other part about it that he goes on is that this Isaiah, he quotes out of Isaiah, and let me just read it for you. He says, one who argues with his creator is in grave danger. One who is like a mere shard among shards on the ground. The clay should not say to the potter, what in the world are you doing? Your work lacks skill. And the whole idea that Satan loves to get us to is we begin to question God. But the questions that we should be asking are not about Satan and not about trees. And even for that matter, not about us. The questions we must be asking are about God and his glory and his purpose and his fame. See, the thing we don't like to realize is in that garden, God had a purpose. And when he allowed those things in, he had a purpose in that we would know him better, see him better, understand him better. And that the reason that the serpent even was allowed in is given inside of the curse, that when God goes to hand down the curse, he looks at basically at the serpent and he looks at Eve and he helps them to understand, listen to me. I'm going to cause between the two of you a hostility. And it's going to come down to this idea between her offspring and your offspring. And then he says this amazing statement. He says, he, being the offspring to come, will strike your head and you will strike his heel. What God was doing was, is I allowed you in here. And the New Testament, I think, more fully explains it. I let you in here because King Jesus is going to defeat you. He will somehow be more glorified, he'll be more honored, he'll be more exalted in the end because he defeats Satan through the exact opposite of what we tend to do, the exact opposite being through raw power. He doesn't go that way. In fact, the whole Bible, the whole New Testament explains this idea that the way that Jesus wins, and I love this, we see other ways in which God does exert himself in just this absolute power, but there's this other side of it through suffering and patience and humility and servanthood and even the curse of the fall, death. Jesus wins. And we would never have known that side of Jesus apart from it. And the more that King Jesus is honored, you got to understand something, the better it is for those of us that know him. He had demonstrated amazingly on the cross when he died, this sacrifice and this triumph over the devil. And Paul said, when he said this, he said, we preach Christ crucified to the world. The Jews would have said, no, the Messiah can't die. And the Gentiles would have said, no, what are you talking about? Why would we ever follow a criminal that has been crucified on a cross? But the way Paul frames it right after that is he says, no, it is the power of God and the wisdom of God. In other words, what he's saying is that in the garden, God had a purpose and God had a plan. And Satan, in all of his mayhem and destruction and everything that he is about, that he serves himself, we would not know the fullness of who Jesus is had this not taken place. I think ultimately, even the answer that we really hate is this idea that God does what God wants, and he has very good reasons for it. He's God. But we've got to wrestle with this, because while we don't know fully all the things that God is doing, the bottom line we have to acknowledge is that nothing or no one can thwart God's will. And in the end, he will triumph. And when we're all standing finally one day, in 1 Corinthians 13, it says, we only see in part, but one day when we stand in front of God, won't it be exciting to know, God, what were you doing? And he just begins to lay out for you the victory of Jesus in ways that we could never understand. Now, I say all this for a purpose, because we're about ready to talk about this concept of the flood. And the thing I don't want you to miss today, and that's what I'm talking about, today's not Happy Pants Day. And the only reason I say that, I'm saying this to you because I love you. I feel too often what we try to do is we try to paint a smile on things. And the reason is, if we put a smile on this one that's weird, it totally takes away from the beauty and glory of Jesus. Because this is one of the most important realities, I think, that are addressed in each other's lives. And when you're able to look at life through this idea that God has purpose in everything, even though I'll confess to you at times it's extremely difficult, but it changes everything when I understand God ultimately has purpose in everything. There's nothing that he doesn't have purpose in. And when it comes to the flood, boy, this reality has to shape our thinking. Because let me just tell you something. God chose to kill millions of people. Just think about that for a second. God had a purpose in drowning millions of people. My daughter and my son were taking a bath the other night, and they were playing with this. Isn't it cute? Why is there always giraffes on the ark? But I'm sitting there watching that, and I've been studying this whole thing on Noah's Ark. And all of a sudden, I look down in there, and here's this boat just floating like this. And my kids are all like, aw, so cute. And there's a little whale behind it, you know, with its little spout. Psh, psh. Have you ever thought about what happened on this event? Like, have you ever seen pictures of Noah on his ark? It's always this. And the animals. Really? Do you honestly think that? Like, do you honestly think if you went back in that time that Noah's sitting there going, the Lord told Noah to build him an ark. When God came down, he came down to a world it talks about in Genesis 6 that was absolutely sinful. And kind of looking through this, the way that he describes it is that they were evil in their hearts, is the way he talked it. And not only were they evil in their hearts, but this nasty offspring of the fall, this idea of just their sin that had developed out and out and out, all these sinners were colliding in this unique way that it was unending conflict, according to Genesis 6:5. In fact, every adjective, every adverb emphatically speaks to the extent of the total depravity that it absolutely swept the earth. Not only that, but it even got down to the core of who they were. It wasn't just that on the external you were seeing this, but God says he came down and he saw every human. He saw their heart. And one guy put it this way when I was reading him. He says, the way that the Bible speaks about it is that God looked into the heart of mankind. He saw that everything formed there, everything developed there, everything designed there, everything conceived there, every image, every idea, every ideology, every thought pattern, every philosophy, every self-styled religious view, all of it, everything that was formed in men was only evil continually. And the thing that he talks about in chapter 6, verse 11 is that the earth then was filled with violence. Everything was shaping and forming, and everything was coming together in such a way that this violence was happening. The word violence is used other places in the New Testament, and it speaks of things like unjust treatment and deadly assault and murder and rape. What did God see? The thing that he explains it as in Genesis 6 is that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Can you imagine just from a world, just everyone evil, 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 evil? And God's plan that he comes down and he lets Noah know about is that I'm going to wipe out the human race. I'm going to eliminate all of humanity. Because it's so pervasively wicked, the idea that he was going to erase humans from the planet. Now, this is important. It relates to what we talked about in the fall. While the passages that we're talking about, they accuse humanity or indict humanity, there's something that is so important in Genesis 6 that I don't want you to miss. While the Bible includes man, the main point of the Bible is not man, it's God. And more importantly, what happens with the flood is that it exalts God. And it's what I talked about early. Do you believe that God has purpose in everything? And it becomes clear from this passage, and the thing that I love about it, and the thing I'm so excited about is that we have a God that will not tolerate sin. And the reason he won't is because it's this word that's talked about in the Bible. He's holy. He's other. And as we said before, he does nothing without purpose. So we know that when it comes to acting out judgment, he wasn't acting impulsively. He wasn't this person like the gods that were all around them that they would have a bad day and they would throw a fit. He was Yahweh. He was different. He was other. He isn't fickle. He's always consistent. Not only is he always consistent, but he's always holy. He's other. He's not like us in how he reacts. Corruption, however, had gone beyond the point of recovery, and God comes into this, and his patience, he says, is done, and he looks at Noah and says, I'm going to drown the earth. I mean, the thing that I tried to imagine is a world of people, and no one would acknowledge him, no one would seek him, no one would embrace him. All he saw as he looked on this earth was mayhem, chaos, and violence that came from evil-hearted people. But the thing that I love about this text in Genesis 6, and this is the part that I kind of miss too often. So is God some cold, heartless being that merely carried out punishment because that's what he's supposed to do? And the answer is no, and I love this. If you look down in Genesis 6, what it comes out of it is that God felt sadness. He uses an anthropomorphism or this expression that somehow explains human characteristics in a non-human. He's God. And the thing that it's talking about is the way in which God expresses sorrow. It wasn't that he was sorry that somehow that he had made them, and obviously God wasn't sorry in the sense that somehow that, you know, he got caught off guard or he got bad news that day. It was something so other than that. Doesn't make him less sorrowful because somehow it's man's guilt, and his sadness is not tied to like some surprise, but his sadness is tied to the fact that this God understands that these ones that he's created, he has to administer justice. It was inevitable is the way it's talking about it. See, God doesn't want to get us this idea that somehow there's glee or apathy when he has to judge. There isn't. But the thing about it is God will not turn a blind eye to sin. I mean, don't you love it that God isn't a God in heaven that's turning his head and kind of sweeping it under the rug? 3 days ago, I was at a store, and I was behind that woman that has that kid that just drives you up the wall. And that kid was sitting there playing with everything. And finally she looks over at me and she goes, oh, you know, kids are just kids. I know what my mom would have done to that kid. She turns the blind eye to it. We have a God that doesn't turn the blind eye to it. In fact, it's this building of this case, and everything that Matt is going to preach about next week is that it's demanding. I cannot in any way satisfy that holy God. He's crying out, we need a Savior. You can't do it. Everything about his justice is telling the world, you do not have the capacity because your heart is wrong. You need me. There's a sadness, I think, as well, because God is looking back and he's remembering as Adam named those animals and as he saw his wife for the first time. And now what he sees is just a planet loaded with people saying, we don't need you. The thing I love about this passage, though, is this word that says, but Noah. In fact, when he talks about Noah, it says, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah's a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. Back in chapter 4, we hear about these groups of people. At the very end of it, there was this guy named Enosh that was born to Seth, who was born to Adam and Eve. And it says, at that point, this group of people began to call upon the name of the Lord. And out of how many ever generations there were between Enosh and when we get to this idea of Noah, suddenly, not only was there nobody anymore, but there was one man, Noah. I love this because God always has a remnant of people. You can't thwart God. There's always this group of people that are going to proclaim the name of the Lord. And before you ask why only this remnant thing, just sit there and be thankful that God always preserves a remnant. That's what the Bible is about. And while there's groups of people that disregard and rebel, there are always groups that walk with God. Look down in there in chapter 6. There's just this group of people that walk with God. And here's the kicker. He comes up to this dude sitting in the middle of the desert, and this is what he says to him. I'm going to rain on the world, water's going to come up from it, and I want you to build a boat. And Noah must have been sitting there going, excuse me? In fact, I can just imagine him in some ways having to go, you know what, God, that whole boat thing, big boat thing, can you explain it to me again? Because I got to talk to my wife about this one. If I've got a 120-year project and I'm going to be on that thing for a year, her and I really got to talk. But Hebrews 11 says something so different. Hebrews 11 says, by faith Noah, being warned by God concerning the events yet unseen, it says, in reverent fear he constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes from God. Let me tell you something. When it says Noah walked with God, there is no safer place than walking with God. In the midst of all this that's about to happen, and Jesus talks about later on in the Gospels, he says, look, this flood thing was only an example of the greater thing to come. Just sitting here today, listen to me. I promise you, in the same way that there was a flood, one day Jesus is coming back, and it's not going to be about judging people anymore by water. The whole idea is that he will judge people by fire. And those of you in this room that don't know Jesus, you got to understand something. God hates sin, and he will carry out judgment on you. I don't know all of you. I don't know where you come from. But if you are not one like Noah who walks with God, oh, I wouldn't want to be there when Jesus comes back. I know we don't like to talk about it, and I know it's uncomfortable, but it's so important for us to understand, because through Noah's life in the book of 2 Peter, it talks about that Peter became this one who preached righteousness. In other words, for 120 years, he just preached, and he preached, and he preached, and at the very end of it, nobody believed. But here's the thing. At the very end, God put them on the boat, and he said, I'm done. And that's what I mean. Those little pictures sometimes we draw of Noah and all of them all happy. Can you imagine as that door shut around them? And all of a sudden, for the first time, Noah heard rain begin to fall on top of the ark. as it fell. It must have jostled the boat because it promised in there that God was going to send not only water from above. In fact, there might be more water underneath the subterranean reality of the earth than there is on the surface. In other words, there is so much water underneath the earth's surface. And the thing about it is that the Bible talks about it just gushed to the surface. And we always think about it as, oh, no big deal, really? Remember seeing the footage of the tsunami? Remember watching as that tsunami would just roll in as and it came in, it just took cars and buildings and just enveloped it and absolutely destroyed all things. In other words, that's what's happening right now. And on the ark that Noah and his family are on, it must have been outside of it, just groups of people that were sitting there banging on the door, screaming to let us in and screaming at Noah to somehow bring them into this ark. And they're hearing the screaming and they're hearing the pounding. And then all of a sudden, after so long, we don't know when, but the pounding stopped and the screaming stopped. And it must have just been he and his family sitting there going, whoa. And for 40 days and 40 nights, that rain came down, and then they just drifted with the reality that below them, everything was destroyed. Our God is a holy God, and he hates sin. And Genesis 6 through 9 is all this story about how he hates sin and how he won't put up with it. But I love at the very end, what happens is that suddenly as they come out, and they must have on some level been so glad to be out of there, but as they got off and they're thrilled to escape this devastation, it must have just broke their heart to come out and see what it looks like after a flood of that extent. But in the middle of it, you see God's favor where suddenly there's just a rainbow that appears. And God points up at that rainbow and says, see that right there? That'll be a covenant between you and I that I will never, ever destroy the earth. The other day I was watching the YouTube of the guy that saw the rainbow up in Big Bear. Has everybody seen that? It's this guy that gets up there and he's like, no way, no way. And he sees this double rainbow and it's just like, I'm like, whoa, dude. But do you understand when we see that, we should just be groups of people feeling the same way. But every time we see a rainbow, we're kind of bored by it, aren't we? Unless it's like a double rainbow, then we're like, well, that's cool. But do you understand that God hangs that rainbow in there because he made a promise to Noah, I'm never going to do this to the world by water again. In other words, every time we see a rainbow, and I realize that doesn't happen much in California, but when we see it, we should be going, whoa! Yes! Our God is good. He is holy and he won't put up with sin, but that rainbow up there reminds us he loves us. And he always warns us before. And I'm standing here today, and let me just say it again to any of you that don't know Jesus, I am one standing here crying, warning you, letting you know that in the same way, in fact, Jesus talked about it, there will be giving and taking of marriage, there will be eating, there will be all these things going on. And he said in the same way suddenly that flood came on Noah, he says, look, my return is going to happen. And aren't you glad that eventually God goes, that's enough? Aren't you glad that in this world that seems to be decaying and falling apart, that he has this point at which he goes, you know what? It's now crossed that line. And God the Father looks at the Son and he says, go get him. See, the first part about it, God has purpose in everything, but we serve a God that's holy. And as soon as they got off the boat, as soon as they're out there and they're standing out there, this group of eight, and they begin to reproduce and reproduce because that's what God told them to do, and they became very good at reproducing. They were very fruitful and they multiplied. Within six generations, probably, there were 35,000 people. They did exactly what God called them to do in Genesis 9:1. But the thing about it is, those people that got off the boat, they brought with them the nasty thing from way back in the garden. They brought sin. after God had destroyed everything, Genesis says that now this group of people were living on this plain called Shinar. And as they're living on this plain called Shinar, they're this group of people that speak with the exact same tongue and the exact same words. They have the same exact vocabulary. There's not like England English and American English and Australian English and Deep South English. In other words, they were just one group of people that spoke with the same language, same stories. All these different group of people, they're sitting there, and on one level you'd think, oh, that sounds so good. And some would even say, man, that's what I want the world to be. Imagine world peace. But there's a deadly dark side to which he's going to talk about with this unity. See, not only is there purpose back here, not only is there holiness, but when God destroyed all the life, the thing that lived was sin, and it bore this process, and about 100 to 300 years later, here's this group of people, this 35,000 group of people, six generations later, that attitude that Adam had, that same reality that he lived with, and the group, that, not only that, but the group that went into the flood, this was all true, but now there was something different. This group of people was looking at God and saying, skip you, we're not moving. God said, I want you to fill the earth, and one person steps over. His name was Nimrod. We find that in Genesis 10. What a phenomenal name. We're going to name our third son that. But he says, look, I want you to fill the world. And this man named Nimrod gets in front of that 35,000 people and he says, we ain't going. You're not going. They were proud. They were rebellious. This guy named Nimrod we find in chapter 10. He was one that literally the way that it talks about it was he was a mighty one on the earth. And in fact, not only was he mighty the way it talks about in chapter 10, but even God acknowledged he seems to be the leader of it. See, in chapter 10 in Genesis, what happens is it tells the genealogy of all this group of people, but in the middle of chapter 10, it talks about a division. And literally what that means is that division that took place is explained in chapter 11. And the whole one that lead them through this division was this person named Nimrod. He stands out. Not only that, but if you look down in the text, it says he was a mighty hunter. Now, that doesn't mean he was a hunter in the sense that he went out and shot Bambi. That's not what he's talking about. He was a mighty hunter in the sense that he was a warrior. He didn't kill animals. He killed people. He was the great-grandson of Noah, the grandson of Ham. And he was this one that literally was probably ruthless and deadly. And what he did was he rose to power, not through democratic means. He wasn't going to take a vote. Instead, what happens, he rose to power just through sheer power. And he was the first of many men throughout time to be this one that got himself to the top. And he was determined that somehow, I am going to create an empire. I'm going to create this, and I'm going to look at God and say, no, you cannot move me. You'll see this throughout time, guys like Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander, but the one that comes to my mind, I think, just because I've watched so much History Channel, is Hitler. The best way that I can describe this guy, Nimrod, is he probably looked exactly like Hitler. He was a devious cutthroat who would do anything to get on top. What's interesting, and I haven't figured out completely kind of how this fits together, but this was a world empire that was established by Nimrod in the very same place that God probably built the Garden of Eden. In certain ways, probably what was happening is that Nimrod was grabbing that and he was putting all the people there in the defiance of God. He's saying, I'm going to rebuild the garden. I'm going to provide safety. I'm going to provide them comfort. I'm going to provide them security. And the way you see it is almost him standing in front of all the people in Genesis 11 just saying, look, let's build for ourselves a city, not for God, not in any way for his glory, not for his honor, but let's do it for our name. Let's create a safe and secure and comfortable place. And instead of calling on the name of the Lord anymore, what we're going to do is we're going to make a name for ourselves. I mean, if you've ever watched Hitler's speeches, man, and you know, he's doing all this thing all the time, it was probably this guy that just somewhere in there, he's just this motivator of people. He probably promised to do great things for that group of people, for this empire. He was sick and he was sadistic. And I would say at the bottom end of it, he was this one that was controlled by Satan. And Nimrod, he was just like Hitler being controlled by Satan. This idea was is that he was being led to somehow do the very thing that God didn't want them to do, to shake their fist and say, I know you told us to spread around the world. I know you told us to find joy and contentment and thrill at seeing this entire planet. But God, skip you. We're doing ours. Thing. Let's build a city for ourselves so that we can live together. And the people must have looked at him and said, let's do it. But here's the thing that's most crazy about it. Back in the 30s and 40s, what Hitler had to do was not only take over government, but Hitler also had to do something very strategic, which Satan is very keen on. He had to somehow weasel his way into religion, because one of the things we know is that religion has this fatal capacity to be able to control the people. Now, there's some ways in which, you know, I don't agree with that, but there's some ways that are so true to that, that the religion is able to do that. If you look around the world, man, some of the chaos is because what is happening by people that are in religion. And so what he does with this group of people is he says, look, I'm not just going to, in this unique way now, come and take over the government, but I'm going to provide for you a new God. And the whole idea of this tower that they build was probably like the ziggurats in which were back in the day. These ziggurats were built in such a way that they would go up in this kind of a fashion into a, more of a triangle, kind of almost like what a pyramid was, except they would have these different platforms that would go up to the top. There was nothing inside of them. They were just built around gigantic mounds of fill dirt. And at the very top of it was this room that they called the gate to the heavens. So when it says we're going to build this thing to the heavens, what they're talking about is we're going to build this room. And the idea of the gate of the heavens was is they would make a bed for a god in the hopes that as this god came by, he'd want to stay in this bed and they'd put food on this table, that he would stop and be nourished. And not only that, then they built those stairs so that this god would come down them, and almost like somebody leaving these little crumb trails down to their temple. The temple wasn't up on top. They would hope that the god would come down to this very little temple. And when he got down there, this god, then they could worship him and he could bless them. And then all of a sudden, God comes along and God mocks them. God sees this group of people shaking their fist at him, and as they shake their fist at him, he uses the very words they use. He says, come, let us go down. All throughout this chapter, they've heard, let us do this and let us do that. And finally, God looks at the entire angelic realm and goes, they built the temple so he'd come down. Let's go. God, in essence, says, you created a door from heaven so that I might stop by. Well, guess what? Here I am. And it's almost as if he stoops down all these things that they're building that they're so proud of, and he comes down and it's almost like, oh, that's cute. Look what you built there. You fired bricks. I created the rocks that made that brick. I spun everything to existence. Who are you? The idea that he's talking about is he's looking at them and saying, you honestly think you can tell me what to do? And he looks at these angels and he says, come on, let's confuse their language. It's almost like God just kind of went. And suddenly all these people were speaking different languages. I mean, can you imagine? Like you're sitting there working away, you know, and somebody comes by and you look at him and go, hey, how's it going? And he goes, hola, ¿cómo está? Guten Tag. It's just this thing in which, you know, you're like all this stuff is taking place, and in the middle of all of it taking place, everybody's like, what did you say? I mean, have you ever been to another country where you don't know the language? You freeze. Except for my grandma. My grandma talks later and louder and puts O on the end of every word. I mean, she's just, but it's this thing in which literally when you show up to it, it's just it must have just caused mayhem. And they're sitting around speaking to one another and trying to figure out why they're not able to communicate. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they start to go back to their homes. And as they go back to their homes, they start to hear what they're speaking and they're understanding. In other words, God just went, you think you're honestly not going to do this? And they didn't choose to go apart. God, in his total wisdom and power, said, poof. Why do I say that? We serve a God, and while there's all these governments setting up various things, there's all these people devising plans around this world, there's all these things going on, and do you understand something? That God would come down and look at those and go, oh, that's cute. We serve a God that's unstoppable. This is seven. You can't stop my God. You can't build something big enough. You can't do something cool enough. We thought we were so great putting somebody on the moon. God was already there. Welcome. Ooh. Look at you. We're so proud of ourselves, aren't we? To which God goes, really? You're going to find security in your home? You're going to find security in your retirement? You're going to find security in all these other things? And you're not going to find security in me? You can't stop my God. The purpose that he started, the holiness to which he is, everything is going to come to this conclusion where a trumpet will sound and a shout will happen, and in the end, all things will come and all of us will worship in front of the throne of King Jesus. You can't stop my God. That's who we are. And while we look at so many of those things about this passage, we're like, oh, God, in the middle of all of it is this beautiful picture of a God whose his purposes can't be thwarted. He's holy. He won't put up with sin. Matt's going to talk about it. He's going to provide a means by which now we will be able to come to him. But what God started to do, he's going to finish. That's our God. When you pray to him tonight, when you pray to him today, that's our God. For those of you sitting in this room that are still shaking your fist at God and not coming to him, I want to call you forward now today to understand who Jesus is. Don't fight this one. In the end, you lose. Bow your knee now in front of Jesus, because it won't be pretty later. For those of you that need prayer, maybe you're struggling understanding and this purpose of God. You're struggling understanding his holiness. You're struggling to understand the reality he wins. We'd love to pray with you. Maybe you're somebody in here, you know what, that you know you need to follow Jesus by getting baptized. Come forward today. I don't know where you're at, but let me leave you with three things. Our God's purposes can't be thwarted. He's absolutely holy, and he will triumph. Amen. God, thank you so much for every person that's here. Give us the grace to see you for who you are. You are such a good God. In your precious name we pray.